So I love that video. I thought that was so profound. How many of y'all know what this is? It's a selfie stick, or something that's close to a selfie stick. Selfie sticks are a relatively new invention, a sign of Western ingenuity taking the place of a long line of things like, you know, electric light bulb and penicillins and harnessing nuclear energy, and now the selfie stick. I think in 1,000 years from now, when archaeologists are digging through the rubble that is the 21st century, somebody's going to find that selfie stick and be like, this is where the wheels came off right here. This is where the world started going to pot. Now, a lot of you don't have selfie sticks, but some of you do, and some of you don't remember the last time you let somebody else take your own picture. I read an article a few years ago in the New York Times called Death by Selfie, and it pointed out that because so many, at least at the time, so many people were taking selfies, that you're more likely to die by taking a selfie than you are by getting killed by a shark or getting struck by lightning. And I thought that was interesting. Why are people dying taking selfies? It's because they're doing dumb stuff like leaning over the edge of the Grand Canyon or sticking their head in a tiger cage, a real thing that happened, in order to get the very best shot. We go to such great lengths to get a great picture. And why? Because there's something inside everybody that wants to be friended, followed, liked, and mentioned. Why would we risk so much for so little? Or maybe you're not on social media and it's not the online stuff for you. Maybe it's you want to be known as having the best yard, or that you're, you know, the best dressed, or you have the best resume, or that you can name drop so well. Which reminds me what my friend Isaiah Joe says. Who is that guy again? Is that the guy I met that one time at the game that keeps telling people that they know me? He's so witty. Maybe for you, it's that you can wear that dress, or that you earned that degree, or that you're a doctor, or, you know, whatever it is, that you have the nicest car. Some of us live in houses that we can't afford. We buy clothes to make us look fancy, but we put it on credit. We drive cars we can't afford. Some of us have hair color of people half of our own age. For some of us, it's the wise nods of students pretending like they understand what their teacher is saying, even though their teacher is going to quiz them and find out they don't. For some of us, it's the way that we make a room or house look clean by shoving all the stuff into a closet or a spare bedroom. Or for some of us, it's fudging the scores on the golf scores. For some of it's the carefully photoshopped picture that makes everything look perfect. Or maybe it is social media and you have a large following on Twitter, or you have a check mark, a verified check mark on Instagram. For some of you, it might be that you look cool in high school because you wear polo clothes instead of Goodwill clothes. Or maybe it's that you look cool in college because you wear Goodwill clothes instead of polo clothes. Why do we do this? Why do we spend so much energy on trying to present the best possible version of ourselves, even though it costs us? And it does cost us. So we're in a series right now called Sinning Like a Christian, where we're talking about the 7 deadly sins, or the 7 capital vices. And the reason I wanted to do this one today is because I think this is something that a lot of us struggle with unaware. It is a vice. It's something that for over 1,000 years Christians have called a deadly sin. It keeps you in bondage. But the danger is these days we tend to call this a virtue. You're taught, starting a couple of decades ago, if you want to get ahead, you need to build a platform. You want to stand out. You want to be extraordinary. It used to be that people were famous for doing great things. Now we live in a world where you're just famous for being famous. I'm looking at you, Kardashians. But the truth is, it's easy to pick on, you know, those people, whoever comes to your mind. But the truth is, there's a little Beyonce in every one of us. And I'm convinced that most of what we're talking about, when we're talking about things like building a platform, is stuff that Christians have said was a deadly sin for a long time. It's actually the deadly sin called vainglory. Now, that sounds like an archaic, churchy kind of word, but vainglory is the excessive, disordered desire for recognition and approval from others. And today, it's most clearly seen in things like being a people pleaser. It's, you know, the people who are on social media or on the internet all the time. It's workaholism. It produces anxiety and shame. It's what's behind our inability to say no to people when we need to say no. And then we resent the very people for having asked us. It's what's behind the way we exaggerate our stories, the way we make ourselves the hero of certain things, the way we present ourselves. Vainglory is the appetite every one of us has to be known for something. It doesn't mean you want to be a celebrity. For a lot of you, that's not what you want. But it's whatever you want to be known for. Maybe you want to be known as being intelligent. Maybe you want to be known for being a great mom or whatever it is. It's an appetite to be known. And like all appetites, the more you feed it, the more it grows. It will never be fully satisfied. The more friends and fans and followers you have, the more friends and fans and followers you want. I heard this one preacher say it like this: there is no amount of known that will satisfy your appetite to be known for the thing you have determined you want to be known for. This is what it means when Christians call this a vice. It means the more you feed it, the more the screws turn, and eventually you're trapped by the vice. This is a vice that's especially tempting for those of us who deep down inside feel like we're never going to measure up. We won't be good enough without enough artificial lighting and a little extra polish. Vainglory, the word vain actually means empty. It means empty glory. And after a while, if you give into this vice, you start to feel that way. You start to feel hollow on the inside. Like really, the only thing that's real about you is what other people think about you. This is why our culture is so susceptible to shame right now. It's why you can get people to do anything if you threaten to shame them. Shame is just human limitations. When your limitations, because you're human, are exposed. The limitations of you not being good at everything, or that you have frailty, or you're vulnerable in certain parts. Shame is when people can see those limitations. And the reason we're terrified of those limitations is because we're not talented in every area. Because we don't want everyone to see the emotional problems that we have. And we all have them. But the really sad thing about vainglory is that it works. For a season, you might win the applause and the approval of others, but there is a cost. And the cost is community. Maybe this is why the world, we're so connected. We're more connected than ever, but we're so very lonely. It's because relationships can't flourish when you're using other people as a source of flattery, or for them to be kind of the dull backdrop upon which you can shine, or for other people to be a part of your reputation building program. That you want those friends, not because you want those friends, but because they can share your ideas or your stuff. So real community is one of vainglory's greatest tragedies. Let me give you an example I think all of us can relate to. I bet almost everybody watching this, at least on some level, you're interested in Jesus. Maybe you find Jesus admirable and you want to be like Jesus. Christians have wanted that. We want to follow Jesus and we want to follow Jesus well. But after a while, something happens in the human heart where it goes from us wanting to follow Jesus well to wanting to be seen as following Jesus well. So a lot of people, not just at Pleasant Valley, but in every church in America, a lot of people go to church with fine people. People who have all their stuff together. And I don't know about you, but whenever I'm around fine people, I don't want to share the parts of my life that aren't fine. I don't want to share my weaknesses, because real friendships don't start with people being impressed. Real friendships start by really knowing each other. And the irony of vainglory is that you can get people impressed. You can get people applauding you, but it also involves not just being seen as good, but hiding places where you're not. Because to impress others, there's certain parts of you you can't let them see. So when I was about 16 years old, I grew up homeschooled in Benton. And when I was 16, I had never kissed a girl. And apparently I was hanging out with all the homeschool Casanovas because all of my peers, all of my friends had, and they talked about it. And it became the subject of conversation that I had never kissed anyone. And so one summer, part of my family went to Florida and I got to go with them and I was there for like 2 weeks. And while I was in Florida, it dawned on me that people didn't know what was happening in Florida back home in Arkansas. And just as important, they didn't know what wasn't happening in Florida. So while I was away from home, I came up with this big story about how I met this girl. And you didn't know her, you don't know her, you know, friends or anything. And she does some modeling part-time and stuff. But we started liking each other, and one thing led to another, and I finally had my first kiss. And it was totally a lie. I totally made it up because I was very embarrassed around being around all these Casanova friends of mine. And I came home, and for like a year, I kept up the charade. I made people think that, you know, I went off to Florida and met someone, and that maybe we still stayed in touch, and maybe there's something there. Who knows what Romeo could do in the future? Maybe she's keeping the flame lit for me back in Florida. But after about a year of that, I was hanging out with my friend, Bub. And at one point, he brought up this story just in passing, and it dawned on me. I really like Bub, but Bub doesn't really know me. And so I kind of mustered up what little courage I had and told Bub, hey, remember that story about the girl I met and kissed in Florida? I made that story up. And if you think it is embarrassing being a 16-year-old boy who has never kissed anybody, just imagine how embarrassing it is to tell someone you respect that not only have you still never kissed anybody, but that you were so embarrassed about it, you made up a story about kissing someone. It was incredibly humiliating having to say that out loud. It still is, even now. Even to a camera, it's embarrassing. But I'll tell you this, 20-something years later, Bub is my best friend in the world. And it was on that night he stopped thinking I was cool. And trust me, he has no illusions that I am cool. But it was on that night he stopped thinking I was cool, and I started having a best friend. See, the problem with vainglory is just fame just offers the illusion of being loved. And this is all throughout the Bible. When the Bible talks about glory, almost every single time the Bible talks about glory, and it's positive, it's talking about the glory of God. But most of the time when the Bible's talking about glory and it's not about God, it's negative. It's God warning through the prophets, people like kings and queens and the rich and Pharisees and religious leaders, they're being warned or even condemned for doing things to get false glory. So Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, actually tells religious people, he tells these religious leaders, don't do the acts of righteousness so that you can be seen by others. Because if you do, if you give, if you pray, if you serve so that you can, if you fast so that you can be seen by others, you're not getting your reward, which is from God. So when you fast, when you pray, when you give, don't do it for other people's approval. Do it because God is watching. The relationship Jesus makes between the hypocrites and what makes them hypocrites is why they're doing what they're doing. It's not because they love God, not anymore at least. It's because they want to be seen by other peoples as someone who loves God. And ultimately, that's corrosive to your soul. So later in the Gospel of Matthew, in Matthew 23, Jesus says some stuff that will really get him killed later. He says to those Pharisees and those religious leaders in Matthew 23, 27, and 28, he says, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you're hypocrites. You were like whitewashed tombs. Everything is beautiful on the outside, but on the inside you're full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside you're full of hypocrisy and wickedness. And what I want you to see here is that Jesus is saying this to the religious good people, because vainglory is a problem, a sin that religious good people actually struggle with more than others. Because if you do good things, eventually you're going to get attention for it. People will see you've done something good, you did something selfless. And then after a while, because of the applause, because of the reward, because of the hit of dopamine you get from other people patting you on the back, you start to care subtly, slowly, over time, more about getting those attaboys than actually the thing that you were doing and why you originally were doing it. So imagine that you had my job. You're a preacher. Churches have preachers because they're supposed to tell you the truth. They're supposed to tell you what God is like and what God wants from our life. But after a while, if you go down this slippery slope of vanity, after a while, you start getting some pats on the back because you told the truth, or because you said things a certain way, or because that was a good sermon or whatever. And after a while, you don't tell the truth anymore because you like those pats on the back more than you like telling the truth. Applause is captivating, meaning it can take you captive. As the vice slowly starts to turn, it can pin you into a prison. One of the ways out of it is truthfulness, just telling the truth. And truthfulness is not just about using, you know, saying only true words. Truthfulness is also about how you present yourself. So, for example, this is my Arkansas driver's license. On it, it says that I am 5'8". It says that because 20 years ago when I was getting my driver's license, I was anticipating a growth spurt, and it never came. And every year since, when I have to go in and renew my driver's license, I don't correct them. If you spend any time with me, you know I am not 5'8". But that's not what it says on my driver's license. I'm not trying to say you shouldn't try to have a good reputation, but there is a way to handle having a reputation that doesn't take over your life. So, if you have your Bibles, turn to John chapter 1. In all four Gospels, there is a person that shows up on the scene before Jesus. It's actually somebody that Jesus is related to. It's John the Baptist. And John was a big deal. Thousands of people came out to hear John preach his ministry. John the Baptist went ahead of the Messiah, saying that there was someone who was coming after me who I am not worthy to tie his shoes. He started off his ministry in the wilderness. His clothes were made of camel hair, and he ate bugs for dinner. So he's not the southern kind of Baptist. John the Baptist, when he started his ministry, thousands of people came. It looked like he was going to be the first Billy Graham of his day. He was going to be a celebrity kind of preacher. And he got so big that the religious institutions started to pay attention to him. They sent leaders out there to ask him, John, what's your secret? How are you, you know, drawing such huge crowds out in the wilderness? And in John chapter 1, these are the first words John the Baptist says. In verse 19, now this was John's testimony when the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem sent priests and Levites to ask him who he was. He did not fail to confess, but confessed freely. You catch that? He's not in a vice. He's free. He confessed freely, I am not the Messiah. Now, if there was ever a point in John's ministry where he could grab the spotlight, where he could leverage this attention, this was it. These people are coming to him, they're asking, how did you build such a big ministry? And John could have, you know, gone on to write the, you know, best-selling Christian book or pre-Christian book of, you know, The Secret of the Purpose-Driven Shack or whatever would, you know, sell back in the day. But John refuses to play that game. He lets fame slide off him like Teflon, even though it cost him. And it does cost him. Because little by little, John is going to watch followers unfollow him and go follow Jesus. As the sun is fading on his ministry, his glory and attention are going away, and John isn't bothered at all. But some of his followers are. They come to John a couple of chapters later in chapter 3, starting in verse 26. The followers of John come to him and say, they came to John and say, "Rabbi, that man who was with you on the other side of the Jordan, the one you testified about, look, he is baptizing and everyone is going to him." To this, John replied, and if you get this, it can change your life. It will certainly change your relationship to vainglory. To this, John replied, "A person can receive only what is given them from heaven. You yourself can testify that I said, I am not the Messiah, but am sent ahead of him. The bride belongs to the bridegroom, and the friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That joy is mine, and it is now complete. He must become greater, and I must become less." Did you catch what he said? A person can only receive what has been given them from heaven. That little statement can prepare you. For what kind of life do you want to live? How do you want to feel? How do you want your life to be when the spotlight starts to go away? The day comes, that statement can prepare you for when the day comes when you have fewer friends, fans, and followers. When the new kid on the block or the new guy in the office arrives and you're not the new guy anymore. When you're not the star. When the day comes when your better days are behind you. That idea, he says, it's the only way I know of that you can say something like this in moments like that. I must become less so he can become greater. And underneath it all is a guy you can't imagine without smiling. Could you hear what he said? This joy of mine in this moment when he's losing the spotlight, when he's losing all the attention, he says the joy I have is complete because John the Baptist spent his life pursuing the exact opposite of what most of us pursue. And the word he uses to describe it, that kind of life, is joy. Listen, everybody that I know wants to be a part of something bigger than themselves. But if you want to be a part of something bigger than yourself, it has to be bigger than you, meaning it can't center around you. And the real danger of vainglory is you try to make everything, you try to be the center of everything. Now, you can live that way. You can go with the flow of self-promotion and trying to get your name great, but you will never know how great your impact could have been in the world by being a part of a story larger than you. You will never know the power of belonging to a story that's big enough for you to be small in. You know what's great about the story of John? When angels come to John the Baptist's parents to tell them, you're going to be pregnant, you're going to have a child, listen to how they describe John. In verse 14 of Luke chapter 1, they say to his expecting mom and dad, "He will be a joy and delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth, for he will be great in the sight of the Lord." He will be great in the sight of the Lord. Can I tell you, no matter who you are or what you believe or don't believe, that's what you want. It's not likes and favorites and retweets and jealous stares when you walk into rooms. What you want, what everybody really wants, is to make God smile. And you can be a part of an ingredient of making God happy. And by the way, who would have thought 2,000 years after this, we're not talking about Caesar Augustus, we're not talking about Herod the Great, we're talking about this guy who was trying to give away attention and fame. If you're a Jesus person, this is what we believe. We believe that all of the attention, that all the spotlight that is shined on us is to shine on God, that ultimately what is given from us for God is to point back towards Him. We can only receive that which has been given us from heaven. Practically, what this means is that we get up every day and we do our best. And at the end of the day, we take a deep breath and we listen for the applause from heaven. Vainglory's antidotes are humility, truthfulness, and gratitude. Because a lot of us were born on third base and have tricked ourselves into thinking we hit a triple. Chances are you didn't have a lot to do with the station you're at in life. You didn't pick when you would be born, what family you would be born to, where you would be born. How does that make a difference in how we present ourselves? Tell the truth with how we present ourselves. Would it be difficult for a single day for you not to respond to criticisms? For you to not respond by, well, if you could see it from my angle. Could we listen to other people sincerely without trying to redirect the conversation to be able to tell a story in which we might shine a little brighter or offer an account of how we feel about certain things? And maybe this week you can reflect at the end of a day on how much energy and effort you spent on trying to make your image look as great as possible for other people. In fact, because we're in this season of social distancing and we aren't allowed to get in groups together of large groups of people, so we're talking a lot through Facebook and social media, I want to invite you to consider something. Most of the time we put pictures up on social media, it's pictures like this. This is a picture of Leslie and me and the kids. And, you know, this is, you know, makeup's done, hairs have been combed, teeth have been brushed, matching clothes have been bought, everything looks fine and fancy, and you're tempted to think that this is a normal family. We are a normal family, but I don't know any normal family that looks like that most of the time. But that's the pictures we put on social media. What if this week you put up a picture of your true self? So earlier this week, I woke up and the first thing I did was I didn't put in my contacts. I didn't brush my teeth. I just grabbed my phone and took a selfie. And as embarrassing as this is, I'm going to show it to you now. What if you took one of these pictures this week? As we're all trying to connect in different ways on social media since we can't connect in real life. What if you did this and put it on Instagram or Facebook or whatever and just hashtagged or put a pound sign and then wrote the real me PV? I know you might not want to do that. I get it. I just saw my own picture as well. But in the words of the great theologian Justin Bieber, if you like the way you look this much, maybe you should go and love yourself. Because in the end, all that really matters is the applause of God. So when I was a senior at Harding University, I was a Bible major, and Dr. Ken Neller was one of my professors. I had him for one of my last classes, what we called the Mary and Barry class. It was where you learned how to do weddings and funerals. And towards the end of that class and towards the end of my time at Harding, Dr. Neller was looking out over a bunch of future preachers, and he told a personal testimony. He talked about how when he was first starting out, he was pulled in so many directions by people wanting different things. Preach on this, don't preach on that. Be this kind of Christian leader, don't be that kind. And he was pulled in all these different directions, and he didn't know who to try and make happy. And then at one point, Dr. Neller was just in his personal devotional times, got to the part where it's talking about when we finally see God and the moment of when God sees you in Jesus Christ and the kind of life that you lived, God will say, "Well done, faithful servant." And then Dr. Neller looked up and started to cry. And he wasn't a very emotional person, at least not in his classes. He started to cry, and Dr. Miller said, "And it's when I realized that the reason I got into ministry, the reason I care about ministry is not just because I want to make other people happy, but because I want to contribute to making God happy. I want to hear one day, 'Well done' from God." And it was then that I knew I was ready and able to serve God's church well. A few years ago, I was in Abilene when I heard the news that Dr. Neller had had a severe heart problem and had died. He was a young man for all intents and purposes. And the first thing that I thought was just deep grief for his wife and his sons. But the next thing I thought was, now he's got it. Dr. Kneller has got the one thing he was always chasing, finally. Dr. Kneller finally got to hear God say, "Well done." You know what? That's what every one of us is after. It's the thing behind all the other things. It's not the likes and the retweets and the mentions and the jealous stares. At the end of the day, what every one of us want is to be able to say we did our best to make God known. And if we do that, we can expect to hear the words, "Well done." So if you're wanting the prayers of any godly people today, we've got shepherds. We've got people on the prayer ministry. We've got some of our ministers. If you would like to reach out to get prayers, maybe this is a vice you struggle with like me, or maybe you've got some anxiety about what's going on in the country and world. Maybe you're just tired of being quarantined and need someone to pray with you for patience. You can call any of these godly people. They would love to bless you if you would call them this morning. Okay, my brothers and sisters across Central Arkansas and some of you this country and world right now, until next week, a benediction. May we be good neighbors and friends and co-workers in this season. May the light of Jesus Christ shine brightly in this darkness. And may we live for the glory of God and for the words, "Well done." Go in peace.